ensuring that student debtors are able to stay financially afloat. And so it's not too late. The vote hasn't happened yet. We're encouraging members of Congress and the Biden administration to strike this provision from the deal so that student loan borrowers are not in such a precarious, bad economic situation akin to the student debt crisis before COVID.
Braxton Brewington, I want to thank you for being with us, Press Secretary of the Debt Collective, a group working to end the student loan crisis. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Mermi Sheikh.
From Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... Students in Oregon seeing an impact because of President Biden's actions on student loans. Portland twin brothers are behind a new documentary taking aim at Wall Street. And it's a special day in the history of land-grant universities, including Oregon State. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 1st, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. The Biden administration has announced changes to income-driven repayment plans affecting students, especially those of low incomes. These plans offer good options for student borrowers to pay back their loans. But as Eric Tegedoff reports, many in Oregon who'd benefit most from them don't even know they exist.
A proposal from the federal government could provide a better path towards student loan debt repayment. But a new survey finds many borrowers don't know about this option. While the fate of the Biden administration's debt erasure plan is in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court, income-driven repayment plans offer a next best option for former students. Through such plans, people pay based on their income rather than the amount they borrowed. Oregon student loan ombuds Lane Thompson says a proposal from the U.S. Department of Education would make this type of plan even more attractive.
Let people keep a higher percentage of their earned income, be a smaller percentage of monthly income, and allow for forgiveness after 10 years rather than 20 or 25.
However, a survey from New America finds the people who would benefit most from income-driven repayment plans don't know they exist. According to the report, more than 40% of low-income borrowers had not heard of these plans. Thompson says that's a problem.
It really is an issue that more folks don't know about these, and I think it would be to the benefit of everybody if we knew more about the income-driven repayment plans as borrowers.
Thompson says borrowers also should know about the Fresh Start program. The temporary program gets people out of default and removes the default from their credit report. Borrowers need to contact their loan provider to access the program. Loan repayment is likely to begin later this summer. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A multi-million-dollar settlement with the city of Portland aims at resolving a class action lawsuit. But the disabled people who it aims to help are divided on whether or not it's good for them and the city. Plaintiffs said the homeless tents crowding sidewalks violate their rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
My name is Lauren Waltroff. As one of the plaintiffs on the lawsuit, I got to defend and see Portland through its most challenging times. As a disabled student at college here in Portland, PNCA, and diagnosed with cerebral palsy using a scooter, has been a tough challenge to get through the streets. It's even worse when I have to use my wheelchair because it doubles and triples my time to get to destinations. Living in Portland has been an obstacle course for me, especially when getting to different places.
I live in Northeast Portland. I've lived in Portland since 2009, and for the last few years, it has been exceedingly difficult to go about my day, go to my job, go to the grocery store, go anywhere without encountering these obstacles on the sidewalk.
What I see here is a settlement that attacks one group of disabled people to make another group of disabled people feel better. I have no ill will towards the plaintiffs in the case, even if I've shared words with at least one of them previously. The problem is that the city has been failing in accommodation requests and shelter accessibility for homeless people for years. When I was homeless and in a shelter, I was lucky I didn't have this walker. Getting to my bed would have been impossible. Nothing I've seen has suggested that things have meaningfully improved since then. And yes, I know the city is not directly responsible for shelter management, but it's still a systemic issue.
The settlement pays the plaintiffs $5,000 each and has the city shelling out $20 million in the next 5 years on campsite removals to clear sidewalks. Twin brothers Quinn and Finley Mulligan are Portland-based filmmakers. They will soon release their new documentary about what happened when thousands of retail investors waged a battle with Wall Street hedge funds in January of 2021. Recently, KBOO reporter Owen Bastable interviewed them about their film called Apes Together Strong. Here's an excerpt of that interview.
The apes that we focus on in the film are people that are everyday retail investors who were affected by essentially a corrupt system and decided that they weren't going to just sit back and let it happen.
So that was Quinn Mulligan, one of the directors of a new documentary called Apes Together Strong, coming out on June 5th on Amazon. I had an opportunity to sit down with Quinn and Finley Mulligan to talk about this film. In brief, in January 2021, at the height of the pandemic, visitors to websites such as Reddit and Wall Street Bets were educating one another on how Wall Street hedge fund companies were heavily shorting or betting against companies like GameStop and AMC Theaters. In response, Quinn and Finley Mulligan, along with scores of retail investors, saw an opportunity to buy into GameStop, which led to driving its stock price to over $500 a share. Then on January 28th, online brokerages such as Robinhood and E-Trade pulled the rug under average investors by deleting the buy button on their apps and tanking the price of the stock. So having experienced this themselves, the twin brothers Finley and Quinn Mulligan investigated what exactly happened during the GameStop short squeeze from their perspective, which they described themselves as apes or retail investors. They got a clear message back, yes, please make this movie. And they also received thousands of dollars from people across the world who wanted their stories documented. So I had a chance to interview the Mulligan brothers about their movie, Apes Together Strong. And here is our interview.
The movie that you guys produced is called Apes Together Strong. And we're going to go into detail on different parts of this movie. First of all, I loved it. I thought it was an excellent film.
Thank you.
So here's a quick excerpt from the beginning of the movie.
So in January 2021, we bought into GameStop.
We like the stock.
You maybe heard a bit on the news about this crazy thing that happened where all these basement-dwelling neckbeards on Reddit decided to take down some hedge funds. Yeah, that's part of it, but only part.
Hey, bro, we just need a little intro. That's all.
That's what I'm doing. I'm in the middle of
okay.
it.
Okay, just get to the point, though.
I am.
I wondered about this idea of financial literacy, which I've heard you guys talk about a little bit in other interviews you've given. What was the message you got growing up around finances and money from your mom or from other people around you?
The message that I got loud and clear was it's hard to come by and it's hard to hang on to. You know, like, again, like our mom struggled to raise us and money was a really huge part of that. We had to move apartments a lot. And
a lot
no
of
one really
from the family and all that, but
oh yeah, definitely. Our family was extremely helpful and it was awesome. Like our grandma's great too. But there wasn't a lot of time to sit down and be like, okay, Quinn and Finley, here's the money I have. Here's how best to handle it. It was more like, here's the money I have. Let's go get what groceries we can and get the bills paid. But that even wasn't a conversation. There's no financial literacy in our schools growing up really at all. And I think a lot of people that went to college like right when we did or graduated right around that time, that's a brutal workforce to be joining and trying to find a job that has all the promise of the American dream. Good luck, man.
In the start of this movie, you describe yourselves as millennials. What exactly are you trying to communicate about millennials? What are some of the universals do you think that might resonate with people watching this movie?
You know, I think a lot of the things that millennials are facing today are just more compounded for them. You know, like, especially on the younger end of that spectrum, they're going to have to deal with a planet that's totally collapsing, you know, in a whole bunch of different areas, politically, socially, environmentally. And so I just think some of those issues are a lot more acute for them. That being said, a lot of the people we talk to across the political spectrum, from far right to far left, everywhere in the middle, we talk to people that are, you know, 60, 75. We talk to people that were 18. These issues cover a lot of aspects of our financial markets that touch the pension funds of teachers, firefighters, and anyone that has 401k or any kind of money involved in our stock market.
And that was KBOO reporter Owen Bastable interviewing Portland-based filmmakers and brothers Quinn and Finley Mulligan about their new film, Apes Together Strong. Its release is on Amazon on June 5th. Oregon may expand food stamp eligibility to some undocumented households. And rural areas have a new method of accessing money for roads and bridges. These stories and more in the Yonder Report.
Food stamp eligibility is central to the debt ceiling agreement hammered out between Republicans and the White House. But in Oregon, lawmakers want to expand it by not excluding undocumented households from federal food assistance.
Food brings family together in family gatherings. And so getting this law passed, it will be easy for our families to access our own food from our own country.
Hilda Leone with Central Oregon's Latino Community Association. 62,000 Oregonians are now shut out of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, because of immigration status. And in rural areas, food pantries are rare. A single mother of four, Leon has personal experience with hunger.
A lot of times I had to make a decision, either pay my power bill or go get groceries.
The bill would extend aid to lawful permanent residents and some others who arrived as immigrants or refugees. More than a year after the passage of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, rural communities are struggling to access grants to improve local roads and bridges. The solution? More grants to streamline the undertaking. Susanna Brown says the U.S. Department of Transportation has awarded $21 million to 64 communities.
The recent legislation provides more than $100 billion in federal infrastructure funding, but many rural communities are lacking the time, personnel, and matching funds to apply. Amy Kessler is with the North Central Pennsylvania's Regional Planning and Development Commission.
If I don't have the money to match, I don't have much money to hire a $100,000 consultant to do my cost-benefit analysis.
But some individual states are stepping up to help with the process. Kevin Adam with Arizona's Rural Transportation Advocacy Council says that they're seeing success in accessing funds.
They've already awarded 3 applications, and so we're very hopeful that this will help bring some of that federal funding to these rural, local jurisdictions.
I'm Susanna Brown.
Cemeteries can hold deep significance, and Tennessee is mapping them and building a database. Freelance writer Keith Roydson says the state's Historical Commission wants to avoid desecration of the more than 30,000, often small and isolated, burial sites.
A handful of years ago, a developer bulldozed headstones and prepared to build new buildings on top of graves.
Federal records show Tennessee has more graveyards per 100,000 people than any other state.
They are in some ways a very concrete reminder of our history, not only of where our ancestors were buried, but also to get a feel for what the circumstances were.
The online tool can assist history buffs, genealogists, and developers. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
10 states have restricted abortion access in their 2023 legislative sessions so far, and at least 48 bills were passed involving restrictions for LGBTQ plus individuals. One such law is in Nebraska, where Deborah Van Fleet reports there's already a court challenge against it.
A new Nebraska law is now the subject of a lawsuit filed in the District Court of Lancaster County. In its amended form, LB 574 combined the two most controversial issues of the legislative session, restrictions on gender-affirming medical care for transgender youth and abortion. Now that it is state law, the ACLU and ACLU of Nebraska are suing on behalf of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and Dr. Sarah Traxler of Planned Parenthood North Central States, the umbrella organization for the Heartland Group. Ruth Richardson, CEO of Planned Parenthood North Central States, says the legislature used unprecedented tactics to pass this bill.
The Nebraska legislature has constitutional guardrails in place to prevent such overreach, and it's imperative that lawmakers follow those rules.
According to the ACLU of Nebraska's Legal and Policy Council, the lawsuit focuses on one issue, the Nebraska Constitution's mandate that a legislative bill contain only one subject. Listed as defendants are Nebraska Attorney General Mike Hilders, Governor Jim Pillen, and several Department of Health and Human Services administrators. The lawsuit also seeks injunctive relief to block the law while the suit is pending. Richardson says Nebraskans have already had to go out of state for abortions. She says they have staff in place across their five-state region to help patients access the care they need.
Nebraskans should know they are not alone, and we are ready to help navigate these new restrictions. Nebraskans deserve the right to bodily autonomy and should be entrusted to make the critical health care decisions that are best for them, their families, and their futures.
Dr. Sarah Traxler says she's proud to sign on to this lawsuit and is, in her words, appalled that this is where Nebraska is now.
Politicians have no place in the exam room, but yet here we are. Lawmakers who want to outlaw abortion in this state have a complete disregard for the health and bodily autonomy of the Nebraskans they purport to serve.
According to the ACLU of Nebraska, the defendants have 30 days from the filing date to respond, although injunctive relief could be granted any time. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies down to a low of 47 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, sunny and up to 77. For today in history, we're talking with historian and author Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols. June 1st, 1808. Marked the first U.S. land-grant university being founded as Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. So who better to talk to than somebody who's worked for two OSUs that are both land-grant universities, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. So, Dr. Nichols, tell us about what is a land-grant university? Why are they important?
So the land-grants come from the Morrill Land-Grant Acts, which were passed in 1862 in the Civil War era, obviously. And there was actually a longer-standing movement for starting what were then considered kinds of agricultural colleges or agricultural college acts, but more broadly, colleges to train the citizens of the U.S. In a variety of forms. So if you think about all the places where there are Aggie schools, state universities in their names, like Oregon State University, where I used to work for the last 10 years, those are almost always land-grant institutions. And what they were was a federal effort to transfer and sell federally owned land, which was often obtained, of course, and this is really an important point, from indigenous tribes through seizure as well as treaties and other processes, to sell those federally owned lands or to give them to states and to localities to create a big, potentially big colleges and universities. So you see them in Michigan, like Michigan State University. You see them in Oregon, like Oregon State. And actually in Oregon, you see the University of Oregon as well. Most of them were created then in the 1860s. 1868 is a very common founding point. So interestingly, the 1808 founding of Ohio University is a very early one. It's a precursor before the Morrill Land-Grant Acts. And the big picture thing about land-grant universities and colleges, and something that I really believe in that's important, is that they're really about teaching kind of modern, practical sensibilities to the next generation. So the citizens of the U.S. are as well-versed in everything from kind of sciences to liberal arts to humanities, and especially related to, in the 1860s sense, agriculture and the so-called mechanic arts.
Yeah, it looks like, so there were three different Morrill Acts. The first one in 1862, which seemed like that was mainly aimed toward training more agricultural and industrial workers. The second one addressed race, especially enabling African Americans to get some funding for education. And the third one was addressed at Native American tribal colleges. And that one actually didn't happen until 1994, which is kind of surprising that it took that long for that.
It is indeed. So the second and third are kind of, though, 100 years apart, more about historically Black colleges and universities, for instance, and then also about tribal universities and indigenous access to college education. So what you really see in that sort of 100-year arc, if you think about it that way, is the rise of a kind of egalitarian ethos of citizenship education in the U.S. and the prioritization of having regular citizens have access to college and universities. So it's just to pause and reflect on that. What that really is all about is the fact that before the 1860s, basically only a very small percentage of Americans
were going to colleges and universities, and almost all of them were going to very elite private universities with a handful of other publics that were basically, for all intents and purposes, private, like the university I went to for graduate school, the University of Virginia, founded by Thomas Jefferson, right? These very elite kinds of mostly East Coast and Mid-Atlantic institutions. And this was about, you know, making education accessible to all.
Why has it been important for you as an educator to focus much of your career at land-grant universities?
Well, one thing that I love, didn't necessarily anticipate, but absolutely love, is teaching first-generation students. So students who are the first in their family to go to college or university. They sometimes come with scholarships and fellowships and all kinds of ways to help facilitate that, and sometimes are really bootstrapping it, working 30 or 40 hours a week. And I really love working with those kinds of students who come earnestly looking for ways through education to make themselves better, make their lives better. And also really that type of student, in my experience, generally wants to learn for learning's sake in some ways too. I often find college students are very eager to think vocationally, like they want a business degree to get a business job to make a lot of money. And there's no harm in that necessarily. But I love working with first generation students who are really curious about just plain learning. That's a pleasure. The other thing that I think is important about state universities and land grant universities is that a goal of almost all of them, if you look at their admissions principles, is to bring in the citizens of the state itself and the region secondarily. So, you know, at Oregon State, we got lots and lots, I think it's 70% or so of Oregon students. And we really, you know, you get to know and benefit the state itself, the state economy. You know, I taught lots of social studies teachers, lots of future lawyers, right? The people who are going to be out there making the society better. And we often think about that as training the citizens of the state for the best interest, for the future of the state itself, obviously for the country too. So that's a pleasure. I've taught at a couple private universities, you get students from around the U.S., which you also get at public land-grant institutions, but you get them often much more narrowly thinking about their majors or minors and not necessarily benefiting the individual community in which they're situated, whether it's the city or the state. They're sort of thinking more broadly. That isn't to say that land-grant students don't think broadly. I've had students go off to teach in Europe and go to school in Europe and all around the world, but it is to say that it's the land-grant mission is about the state itself and the region, and that's something I really firmly believe in, helping, whatever the politics, whatever the vocation, helping students find themselves to help make the world better.
Hmm. What would you say to a young person who might be listening to this and thinking, deciding where they want to go to school and looking at a place like OSU? What would you tell them about why they might benefit from going to a land-grant university? What are some of the experiences and some of the, I guess, legacy of that they wouldn't experience elsewhere?
Well, so most land-grant universities, all of them really, are pretty comprehensive, which means you can major in virtually anything. You can and learn about virtually any subject. Because of their long histories, you wind up with universities that have strong alumni pools of very dedicated individuals who want the best of the institution. They often have good donor groups, so they can help sponsor scholarships and fellowships and things like help sporting teams, right? You can have a great experience if you want to root for the Beavers, you know, or if you want to just be in the engineering school, right? And one of the things that the Land Grant Acts did in, you know, helping to generate accessibility to lots of individuals throughout the U.S. to higher education is that it transformed science education in particular. So one of the things I would tell a student is if you're thinking about where you might go, you know, one of the things that you could not have done in the past would have been to have taken a great liberal arts class and a great science class at a land-grant university. That's pretty affordable. But that's another piece of the puzzle here. The idea is to make these more affordable. Unfortunately, higher ed has been defunded by our state legislatures and federal government over time. And so it's not as affordable as it should be, in my opinion. And student debt is a big problem. But if you're looking for affordability and for a great education, land grants are a terrific place to take a strong look. And particularly from like the applied sciences and engineering all the way through the humanities and liberal arts, you can find something for anyone.
Beautiful. Okay. Anything else you want to add about land grants that I haven't asked you?
I mean, one thing that's also worth noting about land grants, just atmospherically, is that because most of them were started in the 1860s and there were big building booms in the late 19th century and also in the early 20th century, you wind up with gorgeous campuses. If you've ever walked through many of the land grant institutions, Oregon State has a fantastic you know, set of quads, two parallel areas that look beautiful with these great old trees and grass. But here at Ohio State University, you have a very similar set of ovals that are beautiful with a lake on it and some gorgeous trees. You know, the settings that these land grant institutions have made are these sort of idyllic kind of areas for education. The goal here is to get people out talking, even classes outside, that kind of thing. So they're also beautiful places simply to, you know, take a tour or to go to school or to work or to live. And part of the reason, actually, I think that you see so many people moving to the communities where land grant institutions are located is because they often have a great community interaction, more kinds of events, more speakers, more talks, more engagement with their community. And then your typical, say, small college town or smaller town in the U.S., they also tend to have more infrastructure. So you'll wind up with hospitals and law schools and things like that that greatly benefit the community too. So you can have a kind of well-rounded experience if you're a student or if you're a member of the community in a college town where a land grant is located because of the long history that they've had in that place and the sort of peculiar, special kinds of interactions they have with the community. I think the more I've been involved with land grants, the more I've realized how special that interaction is between a land grant institution and the community in which it's embedded. There is this critique of land grants that I started with, but I didn't go very far. One of the things that many land grant institutions do today is talk about the fact that they're located on land that's been ceded or seized from indigenous tribes. And that's very true in Oregon. And so that one complicating factor for land grant institutions is that though they prize this great history of trying to educate the broadest possible public and try to make that accessible and affordable, the challenge is that in fact, you know, literally they're on stolen land. And so land grant institutions have tried and have been at the forefront, in my opinion, of meaningful land grant land acknowledgments about the land that they are physically occupying and the surrounding areas that their communities often are part of.
And that was Ohio State University history professor Dr. Chris Nichols. Democrats say a wealth tax would help alleviate some national debt. Lawmakers aim to continue pandemic-era funding for America's child care sector. And teachers say firearms at school will make students less safe. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
But a 2-cent wealth tax will raise $3 trillion over 10 years. That's money we reinvest in America.
Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts says a wealth tax on Americans earning more than $50 million would allow for greater investments in child care, education, and infrastructure, as well as help alleviate some of America's debt. While House Republicans aim to cut social programs in order to raise the debt ceiling, both the House and Senate must pass a debt ceiling bill by Monday to avoid a default. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says the U.S. is facing a child care crisis.
And there is no excuse, if we got our priorities right, why we should not be providing the highest quality of child care for the little ones and to ease problems for their parents.
Pandemic-era funding helped save the child care sector from collapse, but the funding is set to expire in September. A new report finds 30% of child care programs will be forced to cut wages if federal assistance is not continued. A majority of teachers say carrying firearms at school would make students less safe, according to a new survey. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the U.S. should do what other great democracies have done to ban guns.
Children and parents and educators all want and need schools to be safe sanctuaries for teaching and learning, not armed fortresses.
The RAND survey shows only 5% of teachers overall selected gun violence as their largest safety concern, putting bullying at the top of the list, followed by drugs. Nevada Governor Joe Lombardo has signed a bill protecting access to abortion.
I also support pro-life, right? So I don't wish it to be any less restrictive than it currently is.
The legislation protects access to abortion for out-of-state patients and ensures in-state providers cannot be disciplined by medical governing boards or state commissions. The largest ever walkout by Oregon lawmakers is entering its fifth week. Democrats control the state house, but the GOP is leveraging rules requiring 2/3 of lawmakers be present to pass legislation. The governors of Virginia, West Virginia, and South Carolina have joined a growing list of GOP-led states sending their National Guard soldiers to the U.S.-Mexico border. The move is in response to a request from Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who has criticized President Biden's handling of migrants attempting to enter the U.S. And NASA held its first public meeting on UFOs Wednesday. A team of 16 scientists stressed the need for better data collection methods due to the hundreds of military and commercial pilot reports detailing unusual objects in U.S. airspace. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 1st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Owen Bastable, Suzanne Potter, Eric Tegadoff, and Deborah Van Fleet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Dr. Chris Nichols and Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.